joined us. So welcome to us, if the workers have just left work and are joining us for the rest of the day. I've enjoyed my break. Also had my Kit Kat. Other chocolate confectioneries are available, just in case you think the Foundations has got a new sponsor. We're going to try something very difficult now, almost impossible, because remember we said we're not going to discuss doctrines and sort of doctrines that divide us. Well, we're going to discuss doctrines without discussing doctrines, really, because we're going to discuss a book by we, that's David Searle and I. We're going to discuss a book that we both found absolutely fascinating. David came across it first of all. Once I heard about it, I couldn't resist it. It was a must get, must read, must review, and talk about it as much as possible sort of book. And some of you may already have read this and may want to join in discussion later. It's called Finding the Right Hills to Die On. Let me explain very carefully. This doesn't mean at the end of the session you've all got to go out and find the right hill and die on it. Okay, it's not telling you to do that. What it is really saying is, let's think carefully about which battles are worth fighting, and let's discern which doctrines are worth arguing over, which ones are worth dividing over, and which ones we should just walk away from. And I don't know whether you're familiar with that sort of phrase, the title, Finding the Right Hills to Die On. It was new to me, but once it was explained, it was sort of obvious. There's a subtitle as well called The Case for Theological Triage, which might mean more to you if you're in the medical world. The idea being that in major incidents where there's lots of injuries, you have to decide in which order to help people, which is more important. So as the back cover tells us in this book, in theology, just as in battle, we must prioritise doctrine in order of importance. Now, I assumed that when I heard about this, that this was a new idea, that this author got hold of something original, but it didn't take me long to realise that actually it had been tackled before by other people, and even the phrase theological triage had been called coined elsewhere. Nevertheless, that didn't put me off, and I felt there's plenty in it that was worth mulling over in more detail. So David and I are going to talk about it, which means that we're just going to go backwards and forwards a little bit on the various things within the book. So I want to bring David in here to say, first of all, what first impressions the book made on you and what made you want to read it once you realised what was in it. David, what's your first thoughts on this?
Okay, well, I came across the book in a review of it, actually. My background is Brethren, Open Brethren, and it was a Brethren magazine called Partnership, which reviewed it. And my first thoughts were, what's this all about? Particularly when one of the writers said, I cannot overestimate the importance of this relatively short book. The title is a military metaphor, some hills are worth dying on, others are not. The subtitle uses a medical concept. Everyone cannot be treated at once, cases have to be prioritised. They quote the books, which says, there's an old saying, there's no doctrine a fundamentalist won't fight over, and no doctrine a liberal will fight over. Then he suggests, the review tells us that he suggests four basic categories of doctrines. And at this point, alarm bells were starting to go off in my head. First rank doctrines essential to the gospel. And as I explain it, it does become a bit clearer. For example, the Trinity, virgin birth, justification. Second rank doctrines are urgent for the health and practice of the local church and frequently cause Christians and denominations to separate. For example, baptism, spiritual gifts. In a ministry. Third rank doctrines are important to Christian theology, but not enough to justify separation among Christians, e.g. the millennium, the days of creation. Fourth rank doctrines are unimportant to gospel witness and ministry collaboration, e.g. worship music and instrumentation, the number of angels. He explains why primary doctrines are worth fighting over and how to navigate the complexity of secondary doctrines and why we should not divide over tertiary doctrines. And the final chapter is a call to theological humility. Well, I was struck by that, particularly as knowing their 14 was going to be about when Christians disagree. So that sort of piqued my interest, although alarm bells were still going off. But first impressions, well, when I discovered the term theological triage, was coined by Al Mohler, who is a Southern Baptist in America, head of a college, and with an introduction by Don Carson. I thought, well, okay, the idea has got some quite sound names behind it, but what's it all about? I read the whole book thinking, is this right? Surely all doctrine is important. Now, bearing in mind my Brethren background and partnership, thought it okay, but it got me thinking. I've read it a couple of times now. The point is that we triage doctrines in order to work out a basis for getting along with one another, not as some theological ranking. So I don't know how much you want me to say on that, Paul, but that was my initial first reaction on it.
Fair enough. That's got us into what the book's about quite nicely. As I say, I assumed this was going to be totally original, and once I got over that slight disappointment, I began to find it quite stimulating. He comes up with four categories in terms of what's essential, I think he says, and urgent, important, not important. He quotes other people who have also divided doctrines into four categories, but with slightly different names or different ways of describing it. So that gives you some indication that it's a bit of a subjective approach. The other categories that people have come up with are core beliefs, convictions, which have a significant impact but are not core, opinions, which are less clear issues, generally not worth dividing over, and then questions that are currently unsettled. So that's another person's view on how to split them up. Always seems to be four, however people do it. Someone else has come up with doctrines that are essential for the life of the church, some for the health of the church, those for the practice of the local church, and those that are more speculative. So I felt that he went for a sort of more generalised set of titles, essential, urgent, important, unimportant. And as we go through this, we'll realise that he struggles a little bit to hold to those particular categories. So what do you think about his four categories, essential, urgent, important, unimportant? Is that too vague a description, or do you think it fits quite well?
Well, I think we have to firstly recognise this book comes from the Gospel Coalition, which is a grouping in America of, how do they call themselves, Young, Restless and Reformed? I'm looking for a nod from David Andrew there, but I'm not seeing it. so I got the nod, thank you. Which is a reform, but highly focused on the gospel. And as I read the book, I thought, yes, this is his focus. What is important for sharing the gospel? What aspects of theology can we disagree on, but still work with people in preaching the gospel, in outreach? That seems to be his entire focus of these four categories. So when you look at it from that point of view, yes, important, he ranks those up top, doesn't he? Urgent are things that we may disagree on, to the point of not being able to be in church with people. Obviously the important ones, the Trinity and things like that, the virgin birth, atonement, the resurrection of Christ, and those that are absolutely essential to the gospel. And so, yeah, it works from that point of view. I think the thing that struck me initially, I mean, I thought all doctrine's important. We can't ignore any of it. We shouldn't be ranking it, you know, one important one. I've got something to say about that perhaps later on.
Yeah.
But the point is, we probably are all doing this all the time. And that's what really struck me. For example, David Andrew mentioned earlier, the COVID thing separating the church. But you think about that. We are commanded, forsake not the assembling of yourselves together. I think the holy kiss is very difficult in Zoom. Perhaps it's a bit more holy than it would be otherwise. But, but we are, you know, avoiding physical contact, but yet we are to respect the government. So, you know, are we disobeying God by not meeting together? Zoom doesn't actually replace that. Yeah. So, I mean, that's just one simple example. It's very appropriate at the moment. But yeah, we all do it all the time, and there are many examples of things that maybe we push down in our consciousness.
You're right, we do. And some of us do it with more thought because we feel we have to, and others just do it out of, I suppose, what we feel. So, yeah, and by all means, we're going to give you a little slot later on to discuss this issue, the assumption that not all doctrines are equal. I think you want to say something about that in more length, and we'll do that at the end so that it doesn't get in the way at this particular point. But he does start off, I think, quite usefully, still in his introduction, with giving some fictional scenarios for you to think about, again, that you might do almost subconsciously. One or two of them I quite like. They certainly got me into his book. You're relatively new on the pastoral staff at a local church, and a particular song the congregation is accustomed to singing, you have a reservation about some of its lyrics. Well, I've certainly been there in terms of some of the songs that we sing. Is that a big enough deal to address? And how soon do you take before you tackle this? And how do you go about doing it? So that's one scenario. Another one is where you've really enjoyed listening to a particular Bible teacher for a long time, particularly perhaps on the radio or on the TV or something. And then suddenly he starts to introduce a certain doctrine, let's say in this case, the health and wealth prosperity doctrine. And suddenly you realize, ooh, I'm not sure where he is now on this. So it makes you reassess there. So at least he gets us into it with some sort of real life scenarios. Did you find those particularly useful?
I did, because it rather than thinking of it as an abstract, theoretical thing discussing doctrines, it actually puts it into a rank, and you're working in a ministry, and a ministry goes in a particular way. I mean, some of it I could relate to. I work in a ministry in Africa, where the leader is quite Arminian, but I worked with a guy in the ministry who was actually on the board, who's very strongly Calvinist Reformed. I tend towards that side of the divide rather than the other, but equally I'm pre-millennial and he's amillennial. So, and we were able to serve and work together in Africa, despite those, what people might consider theological differences. We probably couldn't be in church together, but we could work together. So these things actually made sense of what, of the whole question, a theological trial, which I was doing it without realising it.
Yeah.
We've got a question from Gwen Staveley.
Okay. We're going to take questions later. I should have mentioned that, but we'll see what it's like then. But we'll go on. Just say something now then. Is it Gwen?
Who is...
Yeah, hi.
You're muted.
My husband wants to know who the book is by.
Oh, beg your pardon. That's a very good question. Don't mind interrupting that. So I did hold it up. It's called Gavin Ortlund.
Oh, Ortlund. Okay.
Ortlund.
Yes.
Not Ortberg, Ortlund.
Ortlund.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, thank you.
and it is published by Crossways, isn't it? Yes. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
The title is?
Finding the Right Hills to Die On.
Oh, wow. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Okay, thanks for reminding us on essential things like that. As I say, we'll open it up to questions more generally later. Some useful practical examples to start with. And then from my point of view, I couldn't wait for him to get into the main part of the book, which is, oh, let's really tackle these and put them into the different categories and so on. Instead, he spends part one still discussing why do it in the first place. And then he has two chapters on doctrinal sectarianism and doctrinal minimalism, which for me, I won't say they're boring, but they seem to slow the whole book down when I wanted to actually get down to the nitty-gritty. But David, tell us why you think he has to spend time talking about those two aspects of things.
Well, I think really he's getting at the way we can come to this whole question of doctrine. It either makes us want to fight our corner, and that quote comes back again, there's no doctrine that a fundamentalist won't fight over. And then the other side, minimalism, where we minimalize it, and several people have mentioned this already, we can't have truth because truth causes division, and so we minimalize the truth so that we can have fellowship. All we need is all we need is love. I found those chapters quite interesting. Yes, I agree, it slowed it down a bit. I thought they were quite important. It talks about Jesus saying that was the greatest commandment, but the nitpicking Pharisees should consider the weight of matters of the law, things like that. And this was one, a quote that really impacted me. Our love of theology should not exceed our love of people. But then I thought, well, surely we've got to balance that with the greatest command, which of course is to love the Lord your God with all your hearts and your neighbour as yourself. But then he quotes somewhere, I couldn't find it. I wrote it down, then couldn't find it. He quotes Billy Graham, who said, "Hot heads and cold hearts never resolved anything." And I thought that was quite an important distinction. We get them, I come from a background where people, I've had brethren arguing in a Bible study, almost to the point of fisticuffs, so and it didn't achieve anything. But then minimalizing it, we might think that ranking doctrines is, well, are we in danger of saying these things are unimportant? But it's the wrong question. It's the question as to whether things are essential. But again, we come back to essential for what, and might want to deal with that. Yeah. A bit later on.
So, yeah, I gritted my teeth and waded my way through those two chapters, realising that he probably did have a good purpose in distinguishing between them, particularly this doctrinal minimalism that says, let's just love God and people and that'll do. I think he keeps saying that all you need is love. That's the gospel of John and Paul, isn't it? Lennon and McCartney, of course. Or the Merseyside doctrine, someone called it the Merseyside gospel or something earlier. So, lots of background to all that, which is useful. But then again, in the first part, his third chapter, again, he comes back to his own personal journey. And I did again find that quite useful before we get into the nitty gritty of things. He shares his own story in order to show that, again, this theological triage thing is not an academic exercise, but something that had affected his life profoundly. And he picks out three topics there where presumably he's had to come to terms with in his own ministry how to cope with this. That's infant baptism, the millennium and the days of creation. So I did find, again, that was quite illuminating. And by that time, I really did want to get into the nitty gritty. So any other thoughts so far on?
Yeah, well, I can't find the quote in the book now, but I'm sure it's in this book where it really struck me, the things that he got involved in and how he moved from perhaps a more reformed into a less reformed and then back again in his ministry. I think he settled in a congregational church in the end, didn't he? But talking about baptism, that this is where these things really, the rubber hits the road. More Christians were killed by other Christians over the question of baptism of believers than were killed by the Roman Empire during three centuries of Christian persecution. Even the reformers like Zwingli, however you pronounce his name, said if they want to be baptized by immersion, they want to go under, let them go under. And they drowned people for that. These things have been quite a dramatic challenge to the church in the past, and we've fought over these things to the point of killing one another. And these are technically reformed on the evangelical side of things. So, yeah, the battles or the things that he struggled with. Now, I can't say I was quite with him on creation days, but there you go. Okay. I can read the book and I can disagree, can't I?
Yes.
I'm not disagreeable.
Well, that's the point. And he is, at the end, he is humble enough to say you don't have to follow everything I'm saying here. He's getting us into a thinking process.
That's the point. We need to be thinking about it. Yeah. Not just blindly accepting either what we're told, or sometimes we just land on a phrase in scripture and we sit on that and as though nothing else in scripture applies. So yes, it's was it Rabbi Zacharias's ministry was called Let My People Think, wasn't it? And the prophet says my people perish for lack of knowledge. So yeah, the thinking process.
So we're halfway through the book and at last we've got to his view on primary doctrines, and he chooses two case studies. Obviously, there are lots of them, the virgin birth and justification. I thought he covered both of them extremely well. Also at this point, he has to explain the range of criteria that he's going to use in order to try and classify them. And he sets those out, again, comparing them with what other people have done in their work. Again, I thought he came up with some very good criteria for deciding on this. Is that what you thought?
Yes, I mean, he did, right in that beginning of that chapter. In theology as well as in battle, some hills are worth dying on. If they are lost, everything is lost. You can have a secondary or tertiary doctrine wrong and still have a fruitful life and ministry. So we may disagree over the length of the millennium, the timing of Jesus' return or whatever, but we can still have a fruitful ministry in people being saved. And again, we come back to this, his emphasis is always on the gospel.
Yeah.
So some first-rank doctrines are worth fighting for because they mark a fault line between the gospel and a rival ideology, religion, or worldview. It takes the virgin birth as an example of that. And some of them, because they constitute a material point of the gospel, as with justification. So we might agree, let's say, that the Catholic view on the virgin birth, but we might not be able to work alongside Catholics if we're preaching justification by faith. They might better work on some Catholics who may individually hold it. We have to be careful of putting people in a box and labelling them, don't we?
If I'd had to work out the criteria for this first box, the primary doctrines, I'd have probably come up with things to do with the nature of God and the nature of salvation. And I'd have looked for things that related to those two. That had been the way I'd have set that up to start with. But as we go through the other boxes, we're going to realise that it's not always as simple as that. I liked the point he made about the virgin birth, rather intriguing. He says, even if it's not necessary to every Christian for their salvation, in other words, to actually believe it before they're saved, it is necessary for Christianity, that's the virgin birth, is necessary for Christianity in order to provide that salvation.
Yes,
that's an interesting thing. Yeah. And one of the many interesting points to ponder out of this. And he also says, should we distinguish between what must be affirmed and what must not be denied? Again, a useful distinction, I thought, anyway, once you get your head around what he's really saying there.
I just really think about that one. What must be affirmed? Yes, I mean, we're right. So the creation days, the aspect of that is, were Adam and Eve real people? And if you take them out, then you lose the whole doctrine of original sin. Then you lose a reason to need to be saved. So yes, we have to. We can disagree over some things,
That illustrates very well what we're coming on to with the next box and so on. Because you pull a certain thread, and if you're not careful, other things unravel because of that. And actually, the Bible isn't written in such a way that you can separate things perhaps like that. But when it comes to his secondary doctrines, he actually considers baptism, spiritual gifts, and women in ministry. So he doesn't hold back on that one, does he? but he says, what places a doctrine in this category is that it exerts an influence on the gospel itself, or makes a practical difference to church life or that of the individual. And then he says, oh, this was the hardest category to define. And then he starts to say, well, of course, some secondary doctrines might be almost primary, almost essential, but others might be almost tertiary, just important. And he says, to assume that all secondary doctrines are equally secondary might cause us to gloss over important differences. And I thought, oh, okay, at this point, you're beginning to move away from your nice, neat four boxes, or at least create sort of fuzzy boxes. And eventually what I saw him trying to do was create more of a spectrum in which things might slide a little bit along rather than just being nice, neat, fourfold boxes. So the secondary doctrine box was the most difficult. And I think we'd agree that really is quite tough to know exactly where you put things, and that you can't assume that everything in that box is equally important to everything else in that box.
No, good. The example of baptism, and he distinguished between paedo-baptist and credo-baptist, those who baptize babies and those who baptize adults. But there's a spectrum of views within that. We can't say that everybody who is a member of the Church of England or which are the Scottish churches, baptizes, babies, you know, that they necessarily believe in baptismal regeneration, which is the point. It's more like a sign of the covenant for people in the Reformed. So there's a range of opinions, a range of views, even on a topic like that. And again, we have to be careful of not putting people in boxes and jumping down people's throats because they've used a particular word, but to be, you know, to be more nuanced in our thinking. Not that we are to compromise in those nuances, but to understand really where people are coming from.
Mm. Have you heard of the book 15 Views on the Water Temperature Necessary for Adult Baptism? No, I haven't either, but I bet someone's busy writing it.
Somebody's probably done it, yeah. Someone has written a book on the depth of the water.
Oh, the depth of the water. Oh, I was thinking I was joking. Right. I knew you knew it if there was one.
No, I know one of the authors.
Right. The third category, he comes back to the two things he's mentioned before, the nature of the millennium from Revelation 20 and the creation days of Genesis 1. So he's gone to both ends of the Bible for that. But his main point seems to be that, well, fighting over what he calls these tertiary issues is unhelpful. Doing it at the same time as neglecting primary ones is even worse. And that's the point, isn't it? You start to fight over the ones that are less helpful, and you ignore the ones that are really essential.
Yes, yes, indeed. I think what I've got down here. Yes, I think with coming up to Millennium, Revelation 20 being a difficult passage and a difficult book, he says, that one man's difficult passage is another man's proof text. We all struggle with texts that run contrary to our hell position, whether it's biblical or not. And one thing I don't think he really pulled out of this is we need to decide whether we're fighting for what Scripture plainly says, and he does sort of reference that at one point, or doctrines that have been derived by men, doctrinal statements. I heard of one pastor, I won't say which denomination, who would stick with his denominational confession of faith, even where it was found to contradict Scripture. We need to decide, you know, what are we standing on? Are we standing on a particular approach to Scripture? I'm a dispensationalist of sorts, and people don't like dispensationalists, so you've probably all just written me off for having said that. But you need to understand what I mean by that, and not put me in the same category as maybe John McGee or something like that. You know, but we need to. So, would I die for dispensationalism? Absolutely not. But would I die for justification by faith? Absolutely yes. You know, so that's where we've got to say these views come in.
Well, he doesn't talk about the fourth box. He doesn't give any examples on that. I suppose it's just a matter of anything else that's left over.
How the angels dance on the head of a pin.
Yeah, yes, or the type of feathers on the wings of the archangels. I mean, there's lots of things you can really fight over if you want to.
I did like the quote where he says we need to know what we believe strong enough so that we don't fight, avoid fighting. The best kind of strength is the one that avoids fighting, strong enough not to fight. I thought that was nice, because that's moving on to the whole question of theological humility, which is another topic. I'm sure you're about to go there.
Well, it's the last chapter and it's a good conclusion. He does finish the book really well on that. He points out that he's made a series of personal choices in producing the different aspects of the book. He also explains he's writing from an evangelical Protestant and Reformed position, so he's focused on doctrine and theology, and he could have tackled issues that things like political matters, alcohol, and things like that, which again Christians may well divide on. But his final comments on humility being so important, I think really set the seal on what makes it a very worthwhile book. Do you have any particular quotes on that?
Yes, I did. Yes, I want to go back to it. He interviewed a pastor when producing the book, talking about theological disagreements in church. And the pastor said, I thought my job as a pastor would focus on getting my church members to encourage one another to do what the Bible commands. Instead, most of my job is keeping church members from demanding things of each other that the Bible never does. And then another pastor he quotes says that he finds that when people disagree on things and then he gets them together, what counts most is their attitude. That disagreements can't be resolved if we haven't got an attitude of wanting to resolve it. So our attitude, our going in all guns blazing and whatever, will actually never solve anything. But where there's humility, then that's why it's so important. Yeah. I'm just trying to find a specific quote for that.
Well, there's a good quote, I think it's on about page 146 or something, but...
That's the one, yes, I've just found it. The pastor observed this difference. The presence or absence of humility was generally far more significant than the actual issue at hand for determining a peaceful and fruitful outcome.
Mm.
It's the one I was looking for.
And that earlier quote about the pastor, that also struck me because it made me realise that actually we're making other people's jobs, for want of a better word, much more difficult. And this pastor was just being sort of worn out by having to deal with these kind of arguments.
Yes.
With really doing the proper pastoring job. So
another good quote on the next page is, in life and theology, it is not usually sheer ignorance that causes the most intractable problems, but ignorance about ignorance. So where we are ignorant and we don't know that we're ignorant, that's one reason why humility is so important. Humility teaches us to navigate life with sensitivity to the distinction between what we don't know and what we don't know that we don't know. We're back to that famous quote, there are known knowns, there are known unknowns, and there are unknown knowns, and there are unknown unknowns.
There they are.